This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. My guest today is Simon Singh, who is one of the is joining us from England, and this is one of our longer telephone calls. And unfortunately, it hits him at a bad time of the day, but from England. But he's willing to do this, and we want to express our thanks several times for doing that. But before I go there, I thought I'd throw off a little bit of information that's somewhat related to our topic today. I caught in my Consumer Health Digest, which I get sent to me on a weekly basis. It looks at some of the important information that's going on in healthcare. That Airborne, a product that's been used in quite a bit in the United States for the prevention of colds, theoretically, has the company itself has got themselves into some problems. And in fact, they've agreed to pay $30 million to the Federal Trade Commission on charges that it could not substantiate advertising claims for its alleged cold remedies. This product and many of its similar offsprings were developed by Victoria Knight McDowell and her husband, screenwriter Thomas Wright McDowell. Ms. McDowell is a second-grade teacher, and her husband's a screenwriter, as I said. The products were promised to, quote, boost your immune system to help your body combat germs, end quote, and that users were instructed to, quote, take it at the first sign of a cold symptom or before entering crowded, potentially germ-infested environments, period, end quote. The settlement with the FTC prevents and prohibits unsubstantiated claims that the products reduce the risk or prevent cold, sickness, or infection, protects against or fights germs, or reduces the severity or duration of colds, or protects against cold, sickness, or infection in crowded places. There is also a $6.5 million additional suit for a class action lawsuit against the product or the company. My guest today is Simon Singh. Simon is an interesting individual who got a PhD in particle physics in England before turning to journalism. He's now an author, journalist, and TV producer, and has been well recognized in England for his efforts to help people understand science. And in particular, he was awarded an honorary doctorate degree by the University of the West of England for, quote, in recognition of his outstanding contribution to the public understanding of science, in particular the promotion of science, engineering, and mathematics in schools, and in the building of links between universities and schools. He's recently written a book called Trick or Treatment, Alternative Medicine on Trial with a physician by the name of Edzard Ernst, and it's a real pleasure to have Simon join us on Line 1. Simon, welcome to Line 1.
It's my pleasure. It's nice to talk to you.
The idea of tackling alternative health care in a popular book is not the first time that's happened. There's been a string of them recently. But I'm interested, I guess, in how you came upon the idea of addressing this. What led you and Dr. Ernst to want to review this area?
Well, I think my own reason was that I'm sort of best known for writing about maths and physics and astronomy, and so medicine's not my natural territory. But a few years ago, I'd heard that travelers to tropical countries, young students, were being advised to take homeopathy to protect them against malaria. Now, we might come back to homeopathy later on, but I knew even then, this is going back about 5 years, I think, that homeopathy has no convincing evidence at all to show that it can protect against this deadly disease. And so to check out this claim, I sent a young student to 10 homeopaths. She made up a story that she was supposed to be going to West Africa on a 10-week truck tour. And she said, could the homeopath offer her anything to protect her against malaria? And sure enough, 10 out of 10 homeopaths were willing to give her homeopathic remedies instead of conventional treatments. And this was really shocking to me. We had a story in the newspapers, and the BBC covered it in Britain, revealing the fact that homeopaths were willing to offer ineffective treatments against dangerous diseases. And that was the stage, I think, where I realized that clearly there are people offering medicines that don't work, and clearly there are young people and parents who are taking up some of these treatments. And therefore, there must be some kind of lack of knowledge or misinformation. Now, as I said, my background is not in medicine, so I teamed up with Edzard Ernst. He's probably a world authority on all forms of alternative therapies. He's been studying them for the last 15 years at the University of Exeter, also here in Britain. And the idea was to use his research and the research of many other people and to try and take that rather technical scientific research and to put it into a language that you know, people can understand, and then make the right decisions about which alternative therapies they might use and which ones they maybe ought to avoid.
What, you know, the argument will inevitably come up in this discussion, and in your book you address it, is how do you set the gold standard? How do you decide this is the way we can establish what is real and what is not real? What is there a mechanism? How long has it been in existence? How do you go about doing that?
There is a technique, and I suppose there are a range of techniques. But the astonishing thing is that they're all relatively modern. They've only been around for the last century and a half, and really, to be honest, only in the last century. Before that, it's worth maybe talking briefly about what happened before that stage. Before that, doctors used all sorts of treatments and remedies and concoctions, and nobody knew what worked and what didn't work. People would give arsenic, mercury, lead, all sorts of toxic things to try and cure patients who were already severely sick. And in fact, most doctors probably made their patients, you know, even more sick. And in fact, the wealthier you were, then your doctor was likely to give you even more exotic and extreme treatments. And so wealthy people almost suffered more than the poor people who maybe took a more natural approach to their healthcare. And then things changed about 150 years ago. In particular, a Scottish surgeon came up with the idea of the clinical trial. He maybe didn't use those words, but he came up with the concept of what we today would call a clinical trial. He was trying to find a remedy for scurvy. Now, we understand scurvy today to be a deficiency of vitamin C. Back then, they didn't know why sailors were suffering from this terrible disease. Sailors, of course, weren't getting any fruit. They didn't get their vitamin C. That led to all sorts of nasty repercussions. But to try and find the correct remedy, Lind took the following approach. He took 12 sailors. He put them into 6 pairs. All the sailors had very similar levels of scurvy. He fed them pretty much the same diet. He housed them in pretty much the same part of the ship. But he gave them different remedies. One pair would get seawater. Another pair would get vinegar. A third pair would get cider. A fourth pair would get, say, lemon juice. And the fifth and sixth pairs would get something else. And over the course of just a few weeks, it became incredibly clear that the only remedy that worked was the lemon juice. Those sailors taking lemon juice recovered very rapidly. All the others continued to deteriorate. So by comparing treatments amongst similar patient groups, you can work out which treatments really are effective. And once you have that very basic design of a trial, you can improve it and hone it and refine it. But essentially, that's the way you find out whether something works.
And you point out rather nicely that what might be, or I think could be described as the ancestor of today's allopathic medicine, suffered from the same delusions or same misconceptions about their treatments. And you use the example of George Washington very, very, very well on that. I don't know if you want to speak about that, because I think it's important to recognize that we're going to talk about, or you do a good job of talking about, how allopathic medicine has followed this line of testing hypotheses to see the results. And that's what's probably brought us further apart from what are commonly thought of as complementary and alternative care to a large degree. At least that's how I see things going right now.
I think you're right. I mean, I think the key phrase is evidence-based medicine.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at a treatment, what is the evidence to back it up? And that test of evidence is across the board. It's something that needs to be applied to acupuncture in China, as well as to the latest pharmaceutical product, as well as to bloodletting, which was a treatment applied to General Washington a couple of centuries ago. Bloodletting was a very common and widespread treatment. The idea was that if people were sick, then the disease had somehow gathered in the stagnant blood. And by cutting a vein, you could release the blood and release the toxic agent that was causing the disease. And you perhaps, as I say, cut the skin or maybe apply a leech to the skin. Do whatever you can to remove the blood. One technique that was used was not only to apply a leech, but to cut the end off the leech so that the leech didn't become full. It would just keep on sucking and emptying its blood onto the floor. Now, doctors swore by it. You know, they would see patients that were feverishly thrashing about in their beds after some bloodletting. They were fine. And in fact, what was really happening was that the patients were just becoming sedated due to extra blood loss. But to the doctors, it looked effective. They were convinced, their teachers were convinced, the textbooks were convinced, the ancient Greeks were convinced. Everybody bought into the idea that bloodletting was effective. When it was applied to General Washington, I think he lost pretty much half his blood over the course of about 36 hours. The doctors treating him, the best doctors in America, thought they were doing the best for their president, but in fact they were just draining him of his lifeblood and probably caused his death and certainly did nothing to rescue him. Now, a century or so later, you have this idea of a trial, various trials conducted in various places, particularly in France, where you would take a group of patients with pneumonia, you take another group of patients with pneumonia. You would say, well, we'll apply bloodletting to one group of these patients, but we won't apply bloodletting to the other group. And let's see which group actually does better. And to everybody's surprise, those that had the bloodletting did worse. So bloodletting wasn't actually helping. It was even causing harm. And so that was a real lesson to what was then considered conventional medicine, textbook medicine. And that's what I love about the clinical trial or the whole of sort of evidence-based medicine. It doesn't care about who you are, whether you're the most eminent professor in the world or whether you're just some maverick from the middle of nowhere. Your idea has to be tested in exactly the same way. And if it works and it's successful and it helps patients, it gets embraced. And if it doesn't, it gets rejected. And, of course, there's a huge gray area in the middle where more research is required. But the research dictates to us whether or not something actually works.
So I think, it's important to understand that I look at the thrust of the book is really just looking at that. Can certain therapies stand up to science? And you've not addressed some of the allopathic issues other than some of these discussions about vitamin C and George Washington. But allopathic medicine has had its share of rather bizarre ideas. I remember one where they took the mammary artery and plugged it into the heart thinking that would help angina. And so there's just numerous ones of those. So it's not so much picking on alternative and complementary medicine. I don't see it as much as thinking about how we know what we know and then applying that to this idea of what's being accepted now as complementary and alternative medicine.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I suppose from the outset, it's worth saying that our conclusions are fairly negative about alternative medicine. Now, having said that, alternative medicine covers so many different therapies, we always have quite a range of conclusions. So in some cases, we're quite positive. In other places, we're very negative. But in general, we're negative. And we're not ideologically anti-alternative medicine, not in any way at all. what we do is we simply apply the rules of science. We simply look at the evidence. And where something works, fantastic. Where it doesn't work, we see it as our duty to sort of pass on that information to patients. And you apply those same rules to conventional medicine as well. Our book doesn't happen to be about conventional medicine, but there are plenty of books out there about conventional medicine. But in the same case, it's those same rules, those same tests, those same clinical trials, the same techniques that are being applied to work out what works.
You know, I think of the whole idea of thinking critically and testing ideas that come into our minds to see if they withstand the ideas that we think of how they work is really beginning around the Scientific Revolution, as you had plotted earlier, maybe the 1600s, 1700s. But I was surprised at a comment that you gave attributed to Hippocrates, which said, quote, if someone proposed a new medical treatment, Hippocrates declared that we should use science to decide whether or not it works rather than relying on somebody else's opinion. So in a sense, although this kind of rational thinking has been around for centuries, it really was not really formalized as a way of thinking until several centuries ago. And then, like you said, it's really become a big issue in medicine in the last 50 years or so.
Yes, and I think for most people, I mean, you and I have had you know, very different trainings, but we have a background in science and how science works. And for most people, science isn't an obvious technique. It doesn't run through the core of them in the way it does for us, perhaps. And so we see how science works and we see how it gets to the truth. But for many people, it's much more appealing sometimes to look towards opinion, the opinion of your neighbor, the opinion of the local newspaper columnist, the opinions you find on the web. You know, your own personal experience sometimes is something that you'll rely on. But we would argue in our book that all of those things can be unreliable. And what we really need to do is to look at the most objective form of truth, the fairest form of truth. And that's the kind of truth that you only get by conducting these clinical trials. So for example, in Europe, one of the fastest growing therapies is homeopathy. The idea behind homeopathy is that there are two or three very odd things about it, but perhaps the oddest thing about homeopathy is the smaller the dosage, the more potent the medicine. So let's say we were using onion as a therapy. Instead of having a drop of onion juice, you would dilute and dilute and dilute and dilute and dilute the onion juice over and over and over again, so you have less and less and less of it. And the final homeopathic pill actually typically contains no onion juice whatsoever. Now, that can't really work scientifically, but let's go with it for the time being, because the homeopath will claim it's the memory of the onion juice which is going to heal the patient from, let's say, hay fever. Now, that's the idea of homeopathy. It sounds weird, it sounds bizarre, but the world is full of bizarre things that turned out to be true. So we try and test it. And we might test it by just, you know, I might have hay fever today, I might take a homeopathic pill, I might feel better tomorrow. Now, is it the homeopathic pill that helped me? Or is it the fact that today the weather was different? Is it the fact that I'm also taking a regular antihistamine, and that's what's helped me? Is it because psychologically I'm getting a boost, a kind of placebo effect from taking the homeopathic pill? Or maybe it really is the homeopathic pill that's helping me. The fact that the homeopathic pill is really helping me is only one of the possibilities to explain why I feel better on day two compared to day one. And the only way you can really find out whether or not it's a homeopathic pill that's helping you is to conduct one of these trials. Take 100 people, better still, take 1,000 people with hay fever, give them a homeopathic pill. Take another 1,000 people and just give them a sugar pill, something that you know is completely inactive. Compare the two groups. When you do that, and in fact there have been over 100 clinical trials of homeopathy over the years, still, after 100 clinical trials, there is no convincing evidence that homeopathy works for any condition whatsoever. And yet still people seem to believe that it works. It's still at the heart of a multi-billion dollar global industry. But the truth is, you know, one of the clear conclusions that emerges from the book, homeopathy does not work.
Let me take a second and just remind our listeners, this is Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Simon Singh. He's written a book along with Dr. Edzard Ernst called Trick Our Treatment, Alternative Medicine on Care on Trial. We, on our links at kska.org, there's some links to information about the book, how to get the book, some reviews, as well as some other links to some sites on alternative and complementary medicine. If you've got questions or comments at all during the program, there's several ways you can get us locally, 550-8433, 550-8433, a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as you know, we're now taking emails during the program at line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. If you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday night, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and then we won't be here at that particular time. There are objections that we often hear that science can't address, is not able to address the way these medications work or how a treatment works. Do you want to comment on how you might respond to the fact that science doesn't have the ability to figure out how these medicines work, therefore it can't be used to test it?
Yeah, no, we've been lecturing. The book was published in Europe back in the spring, so we've been talking about this widely throughout Britain over the last few months, and often people at the end of a lecture will ask this very question. The science doesn't understand everything, therefore science doesn't necessarily appreciate how the meridians help in the treatment of a patient. I'm quite happy to say, yeah, no, science doesn't understand everything. Science doesn't, have all the answers. But when it comes to a particular alternative therapy, we don't really care how it works. The only question is, does it work? The first challenge to the alternative therapist is, can you show me that your therapy works? Once you've shown that it works, then we can spend another few years working out how it works. But until something is shown to work, so for example, you have lots of people doing research. We were talking about homeopathy a second ago. There are lots of people trying to work out how homeopathy can work. And I'm thinking, well, why are you wasting your time when at the moment there's no evidence to show that it does work? So, for example, if you take something like anesthetics, when anesthetics were invented, nobody had the foggiest idea how they worked. And in fact, even today, I think we're still a little bit vague on how they work. But the clear fact was that they did work. And so since then, there's been research on the mechanism. So it's the same with alternative medicine. The question of how these things work are kind of irrelevant for the time being. The first and primary question is, do they work? And coming back to your other question, and science definitely knows how to test whether something works. It's a very simple principle, and we've talked about it already. Whatever this thing is that you're trying to test, apply it to one group of people, apply it to another group of people, some other treatment, a rival treatment, the conventional treatment, and compare the two groups. Even with acupuncture. Acupuncture is one of the hardest ones to treat because one of the hardest therapies to test because in the past, what would happen is you'd give people acupuncture and you'd give another group of people nothing at all. Now, the patients who received acupuncture, let's say for some particular pain, those patients would typically show some improvement. Now, the question then is, are they showing an improvement because they are genuinely receiving acupuncture, or is it because of the relaxation of being the acupuncturist company? Is it because of the advice that the acupuncturist is giving them? Is it because of the placebo effect of having a needle inserted into the body? Psychologically, we think we ought to get better, so typically we do. So how do you how do you take all of these other factors into account? Well, my co-author, Edzard Ernst, he developed a type of acupuncture needle which collapses as you insert it into the skin. And so it's like a theatrical stage dagger. And so you give 100 patients real acupuncture, and then you give another 100 patients what's called sham acupuncture, fake acupuncture. Those patients genuinely think they're having real acupuncture, but they're wrong. Nothing is entering their skin. So they're getting the relaxation time, they're getting the interaction with the acupuncturist, they're getting the sensation of having a needle inserted into them, but they're not. They're not having acupuncture. And when you compare those groups, you begin to find out whether or not acupuncture really works. And the results at the moment are that for some types of pain and some types of nausea, there is some borderline evidence that acupuncture may be effective. I think the jury is still out, and maybe more research needs to be done. But from the research so far, we can't discount the effect of acupuncture on pain and nausea. For almost any other therapy, almost any other condition whatsoever, there's no real convincing evidence at all that acupuncture is effective for any of those other conditions, whether we're talking about fertility or addiction or asthma or anything else.
The federal government in the United States, and I'm sure it's similar in the United Kingdom, although I can't off the top of my head say which organization or which licensing body and so forth in England does this. But for a medication that's being used for treatment has to be shown to be safe and effective in, by the Food and Drug Administration and before it can be prescribed by physicians as a general rule. And yet, based on a congressional mandate, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago now, many herbs, many supplements, homeopathy, many of these products are not looked at with the same scrutiny. And there's a number of thoughts that come to mind. One, it's like there's almost a tacit acceptance of the safety and effectiveness of these products when the FDA is not allowed to look at them. And there's been a number of issues that have come back. The most common that I hear about is there's no control what's in these products being sold because there's no federal or oversight. And so a lot of the products have been shown to almost have none of the alleged supposed active ingredient or quite a lot of variation. How important is that to you? Is the same issue an issue in England or the United Kingdom? And what are your comments about that kind of legislation or variability in legislation on these products?
I think the situation is very similar to the one you've described for North America. There's sort of a wild west of alternative medicine where people practice herbal medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, homeopathy in a kind of unregulated way. The government sort of turns a blind eye. And in a way, that's why we wrote the book, because if the government protected the public or regulated it properly, then we wouldn't need to give the patient the sort of information via the book. I think, you know, that they could figure it out from what's legal and allowed and what's safe and effective. But the government doesn't seem to help us with those kind of bits of information. There are moves in Britain, slightly pushed by European standards more generally, to try and regulate some of these therapies. But then you have a slightly strange area, because with something like, let's say, homeopathy again. Homeopathy is a good example to use because scientifically we know with some confidence that there's no significant evidence to show that homeopathy works for anything whatsoever. And there's no reason it should work because, as we said earlier, typically many homeopathic remedies contain no active ingredient whatsoever. So if there's an effort to try and regulate homeopaths to check they've had some kind of training, that if a patient has a serious condition that those homeopaths refer them quickly to a proper doctor and so on, if that kind of regulation is brought in, it sort of helps patients. But on the other hand, it gives homeopaths a sort of level of credibility that perhaps they don't necessarily deserve, because as soon as something's regulated, it sort of sounds as though they must be doing something good if they deserve to be regulated. So it's a kind of a double-edged sword. And I think you raised a couple of other interesting points there, is that the assumption by many people is that these treatments, the alternative treatments, are safe because they're natural or because they're traditional. It's been used for hundreds of years, therefore we know it's safe. In fact, it's quite the opposite. For example, if we look at herbal medicine, we know that all sorts of herbs are full of chemicals, natural chemicals, but they're chemicals nevertheless, and some of them are toxic. They're there to kill insects and fungi and so on. And we take these chemicals as herbal medicines because in some cases they can help us. But in some cases they have adverse reactions. And so just because something's natural, you cannot assume that it's safe. And similarly, just because something's been used for hundreds of years, it doesn't mean that it's safe. There was a Chinese herb, Aristolochia, which was brought to the West and used quite widely in the sort of 70s and 80s. And Belgian doctors began to notice that a few of their patients that were taking Aristolochia as part of a diet supplement were developing kidney problems and indeed kidney failure and eventually in some cases kidney cancer. And what they realized was that this was actually being induced by the Aristolochia. Now, in China, it had never been noticed because a traditional healer might give the herb in May, and it may be 6 months before there's a kidney problem, and they would never tie the two together. It was only in modern times with databases and tracking of patients that it's been possible to identify this risk. It had been used for centuries in China, assumed to be safe. When it's tested more rigorously, it's clear that it's not safe. Now, we know that conventional medicines, you know, also carry some risks. And so with any treatment, you have to weigh up the risks and the benefits. And what we're saying with alternative medicine is you have to do the same thing. Weigh up the risks with the benefits. In some cases, sadly, we don't necessarily know what the risks are because those alternative therapies haven't been thoroughly tested.
You know, I would argue that there's an ethical side to this as well. If I were the discoverer of something that was extremely effective and appeared to be safe, that I ought to seriously study that product and allow others to test it as well to substantiate that safety and effectiveness. By not doing that, we're really not addressing the question about really is it safe and effective, because I could be deluded by that. But if I had something that was really, really effective, I shouldn't, in a sense, keep it to myself. And I think
And also what you're doing is you're encouraging people to actually prove that you're wrong.
Right.
You're saying, look, I think I made a discovery. Can anybody find a mistake in my theory? Can anybody find a mistake in my data? I'm now a journalist now, but the last time I was a practicing scientist, I was part of a collaboration. And within the collaboration, we would have a group called the Godfathers. There were a few women in there as well, but they were called the Godfathers. And if anybody in the research group wanted to present a piece of research to the have it published more to the outside world, we would have to convince the Godfathers that we'd got it right. And it was their job to do as much as they could to destroy us, to undermine us, to pick holes in what we've done, to ask every single awkward question they possibly could. Because the last thing we wanted to do was to make a claim that was fundamentally wrong. And it's the same thing in medicine. If you think you've discovered something amazing, well, before you market it to the public, then make sure that what you've got is really amazing and that you haven't just fooled yourself. And that's really what science is all about, checking that we haven't fooled ourselves and checking that we're not going to fool other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've often seen it written by people who are providing some alternative treatment, and they feel like they're being attacked by science. But when people are questioning how you knew that, what was the study, how was the study done? But in fact, that's exactly how science goes. If you pick up any journal and read an editorial after what is proposed to be a breakthrough treatment, the editorials always has questions about the design. But things march on, and I think it's a reasonable argument that despite these starts and stops, that we've made a huge advance since the Industrial Revolution in Western society based on this technique of testing critically what we think is right.
Yeah, and I think often one of the claims is that you know, alternative medicine don't have the money to do the scientific
mm-hmm.
test.
Right, right.
And I think on the one hand, you know, these are at the heart of a multi-billion-dollar industry, so there's some money there for some testing. There's certainly a huge amount of money available for advertising, so it would be good if some of that was diverted to testing. And in many cases, the testing is there. In many cases, it's negative or unconvincing. But in something like St. John's wort, which is an herbal remedy, there's now growing evidence that that's really effective in the treatment of mild and moderate depression, as effective as many conventional treatments. Now, having said that, you know, and so science seems to back up that as a treatment, I put a couple of caveats there. One is that you should always discuss this with your doctor and make sure that you know, you're being guided in what you're taking. Secondly, make sure that if you do take an herbal supplement like St. John's wort, that the dosage that you're getting is accurate. If you just take a natural plant that's been ground down and put into some kind of tea, you don't really know how much active ingredient is in that tea. Whereas if you buy it in pill form, you should have a better idea of what the dosage is. Also, we were talking a second ago about side effects. Now, St. John's wort might be able to help with mild and moderate depression for some people. That's great. But it has adverse effects, such as accelerating the function of the liver. And when the liver gets accelerated, that will destroy other pharmaceuticals that you might be taking, such as a contraceptive pill or anticoagulants, I think. So, again, you can only take these herbs if you're doing it in discussion with your doctor and you're doing it in a responsible way.
Let me remind our listeners once again, this is Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Simon Singh. He's the author of Trick or Treatment, in the United States, at least the copy of the book I've got. The subtitle is The Undeniable Facts About Alternative Medicine. In England, perhaps it's the subtitle is Alternative Medicine on Trial. If you've got questions or comments, the local number 550-8433, outside of Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email at line1, line1, at kska.org. Simon, we did get one email, and it says, it's from a writer named Adrian, says, explain how acupuncture and homeopathy has worked for both my dogs for years. Have you done, I guess he's asking you, clinical trials on animals? Unfortunately, I don't know what treatment, I don't know what effect we're being asked to comment on, or you're being asked to comment on. But how would you answer that question?
It's a very common point that's made by alternative therapists that, you know, I might say, if we take homeopathy again as a classic example of a therapy that really doesn't seem to work, people will say, well, why does it make me feel better with my hay fever? And I'll say, well, maybe it's just the placebo effect. You know, our minds are incredibly powerful, and the placebo effect is not something to be derided or mocked. It's an amazing part of who we are, and conventional medicines have a placebo effect as well, and we should embrace that and in fact, to some extent, you know, use it as well. So I say to somebody, the reason you feel better with hay fever and homeopathy is because you believe it's going to work, therefore it's just a placebo effect. And so why don't you take an antihistamine? Because then you'll get a real effect plus the placebo effect on top, and you get a double bonus. So they say, okay, well, look, if you think it's just a placebo effect, why does it work on my dog? where my dog's got aches and pains. I give him a homeopathic pill, and my dog doesn't know about the placebo effect, so how can my dog get better? And in fact, what's happening there is that people are these owners are loving pet owners. They want their dogs to get better. They give them a pill. They cradle them. They stroke them. They look for signs of improvement. They perhaps ignore the signs that the dog may still not be well. But they're an unbiased observer. Okay, they're looking at it through blinkered eyes. They want the homeopathy to work. They want their dog to get better. What they may report subsequently may not be the absolute unbiased truth. So what we then do is we do clinical trials with animals because, you know, maybe the homeopathy does work. You know, at the moment, all I'm saying is that the reports are unreliable. So how do we get reliable reports? Well, we take 100 animals, we give them a homeopathic pill, we take another 100 animals, we give them a sugar pill, and we see whether the homeopathy actually works. And this has been done with calves and large herds of cattle with mastitis. And the bottom line is no convincing evidence yet that homeopathy helps animals. And again, that's no great surprise. So you know, these things really can be tested. I would love homeopathy to work. Sad fact is it doesn't. It's just a sad, but you know, the person who's emailed in is clearly a loving, caring pet owner, and clearly their pet, their dog, seems to improve, and I think they're really just getting better because he's just a wonderful owner rather than the acupuncture or the homeopathy he's giving.
Yeah, there's a couple of comments come to my mind. One is, well, how do you know some other treatment may not work even better? Well, we don't know that in this situation. But more importantly, I guess the question comes up, so, Simon, what's the harm? What's the downside then?
Absolutely. If somebody takes, let's say, Reiki or some other treatment, and even if it is just a placebo effect, I said a second ago the placebo effect is very powerful, it's very strong. So even if these therapies are offering just the placebo effect, they're helping patients. So what's wrong with that? And this is one of the things that my co-author, Edzard Ernst, and I thought about long and hard. And in the end, for us, that's not good enough. And there are several reasons. For example, if I'm a Reiki healer, and again, Reiki, there's no convincing evidence that Reiki helps with any real conditions. It's really just a placebo relaxation effect that's going on here. So in order for that to work, I have to convince you that it's going to work. I have to tell you about meridians, and I have to tell you I'm steering the energy of the universe. I'm telling you that I'm balancing your yin and your yang. And I have to make up all sorts of things that just are not true. And so in order to evoke a placebo effect, I'm having to lie to the patient. Maybe I'm lying to myself as well. Maybe I'm misguided. But either way, the patient is being deceived. And in fact, the more that the patient is deceived, the more exaggerated the lie, the bigger the placebo effect. Now, I don't think we should be encouraging deceit between patients and doctors or healers. For decades now, we've developed a more open relationship between doctors and their patients, and I wouldn't want to go backwards. Secondly, if alternative therapists can sell placebos, medicines actually do nothing at all except work on the psychology of the patient, then would we allow the big pharmaceuticals to sell these kind of treatments? Well, no, we wouldn't. There'd be an uproar if the big pharmaceuticals started selling drugs that were completely ineffective and they knew about it and the licensing authorities did nothing to stop them. Thirdly, we also said that conventional treatments also have a placebo effect in addition to the real specific effect. So why on earth would you give a patient just a placebo when you can give them a real therapy, a real pharmaceutical, a real piece of surgery, which also has a placebo effect on top? If you give them just a placebo alternative therapy, you're shortchanging the patient. So there are all sorts of reasons why I think it's not justified. Also, you do have situations where patients have serious conditions, and by seeking out a placebo treatment, they're delaying the onset of the real treatment that they ought to be getting from a properly trained doctor.
Well, Adriana emailed back very quickly and said, thanks for your answer.
Oh, great. Right.
All right, Dr. or Simon, I know you're a...
Can I just say one very quick thing?
Sure.
I mean, it's great that your email is so open-minded because, you know, sometimes people get very entrenched in their views. And I've had a few cases where people have sort of just changed their minds or said, well, actually, I'll go in, I'll think about this, or I'll go in, I'll read about this. And that's really great. Edzard and I think we're very open-minded as authors of the book. We, you know, if research came out tomorrow that showed that acupuncture was an incredibly effective treatment for such and such, well, we would look at that research study in a fair way. We'd look at the number of patients involved. We'd look at the size of the effect. We'd look at the way it was controlled, how well it was conducted, how carefully the patients were blinded. That means they didn't necessarily know what treatment they were getting and so on. And we would be prepared to change our minds tomorrow if the evidence was there. Our conclusions in the book aren't based on our experiences, our friends' experiences, not even based necessarily on Edzard's own research. It's based on the best research from around the world. And you know, we're open-minded to new data, and it's great that your emailer is open-minded to new ideas as well.
So, Simon, let's say I somewhat believe what you're telling me today. How come there is so much money, so much use of unproven treatment in both your country and my country?
I think there are several reasons. In fact, I think in towards the end of the book, we look at why people do spend so much money on alternative medicine. And, you know, a lot of these people are very intelligent, they're very caring, they want to do what's best for themselves and their family. So why are they spending money on treatments that don't work? And we come up with lots of reasons. So, for example, one, unfortunately, is the media. the radio station that we're on now, I'm sure, is a fine radio station, but on many radio stations, you'll find alternative therapies being promoted uncritically. In newspaper columns, there will be millions of pages on the internet that will tell you about the wonders of magnet healing or crystal healing or Hopi ear candling. So the media, in all its different forms, typically likes to tell us that something weird and odd and strange and maverick can heal us of some strange and, you know, some condition that's ailing us. And so, you know, we're sort of being bombarded by that message. At the same time, those who are selling those treatments may have clever marketing or clever advertising that, again, will try and encourage us to take their products. At the same time, you've got celebrities who like to endorse some of these therapies, film stars, in particular sports people. You'll find that, say, a sports person is using a rather bizarre therapy. Now, scientifically, there's no evidence to back up this therapy, but the sports star is using it. Now, the patient at home is thinking, look, if gold medalist athlete is using this therapy, let's say Reiki, then that gold medalist must know about health. You know, after all, they're a trained athlete. If they're using Reiki, Reiki must be good for me as well. Now, what we sometimes forget is that if you're a top track athlete, then you've got so much money to spend on your health that you'll spend a lot of it on conventional treatments, on conventional physio, and you'll have so much money that you can also afford to waste it on things like Reiki and all sorts of other things, which are really just sort of pampering. And so for the person at home that's got a more restricted financial budget, my advice would be not to necessarily waste money on something like Reiki, but to think carefully and to look at the evidence before making that kind of decision. So there are all sorts of odd reasons why, well, maybe not so odd, but very rational reasons why people spend money on these therapies when really they ought to at least think twice. And I should stress again, in the book, we're not negative about every single alternative therapy. We look at them one by one, In many cases, the evidence isn't there, but in some cases, the evidence is mildly or even quite positive.
I have another email, which I think deserves your comments as well. It's from Larry H. It says, I appreciate your guest's suggestions that allopathic medicine has at times not been founded on, quote, evidence-based medicine, end quote. I wish, however, that you held modern medicine to the same standard as you hold complementary medicine, including the many examples of drugs that have supposedly been tested by drug companies but have turned out to have very harmful side effects. Also, what about the treatments many physicians who use therapies and drugs that have been found effective but have not been tested in double-blind objective studies? The fact of the matter is there are many treatments in both arenas that do not work, are worse, are very harmful.
Sorry, there were two points here that I wanted to pick up on. The first point is that if I go to my local drugstore, I live here in London, and I look at the conventional treatments, say, for colds and flu and hay fever and so on, the evidence might vary from excellent to maybe even borderline. So there's a range. But in general, it's on the positive side. And maybe I'd like the evidence to be better than it is, but it's certainly slightly positive and often very positive. If I look at the herbal treatments or if I look at the homeopathic treatments, the level of evidence is embarrassing. It's shameful. And so I think when we compare the two, sure, we need to do more work on conventional treatments. But when it comes to alternative treatments, you know, it's really, it's standing on very, very shaky ground. Much of it is. And that, so I think it's slightly unfair to compare the two so equally as your emailer did. And secondly, you're right, a lot of conventional treatments don't have the gold standard evidence that they should have to back them up, these double-blind clinical trials. But there was a study done recently that looked at the treatments that doctors actually use in hospitals. I think it was run in Oxford a couple of years ago. I'm a bit vague on this. But the figure is about 80%. 80% of treatments that are used are backed up by solid and reliable evidence. And of the remaining 20% of treatments that are used, they're used in situations where there doesn't seem to be an effective treatment that has been proven to work. So doctors merely have to do the best they can. So again, in general, doctors do rely on strong on treatments that are backed by evidence, and that's a movement that's moving forward. That increasingly, this idea of evidence-based medicine is taking a hold. So again, I think your email is being slightly unfair. Conventional medicine, it's not perfect, but it's heading in the right direction. Alternative medicine, not perfect at all. A lot of work still needs to be done.
You know, a thought just came to me that it may help also put this in some frame of reference. I'm a pediatrician. For years, we've treated ear infections with antibiotics. For at least 10 to 15 years, I've heard that Europeans, particularly on the continent, were much less likely to use antibiotics and were telling us in America that the ear infections that we were treating didn't need antibiotics and would heal themselves often on their own. And now we're increasingly seeing evidence from our own studies that that's the case. And I'm not saying that all ear infections, please, people listening, don't need antibiotics. There are certain characteristics of certain ear infections that clearly resolve. And so many of us have backed off the use of antibiotics. Again, showing that by testing, we continue to improve what we're doing. Without testing, you're kind of stagnating and continue to use old techniques that may or may not be useful. And I don't want to, again, I'm not trying to disparage anything. I'm just saying, what's the advantage of doing this? And I think it helps us move ahead as a culture in a number of ways to take this way of thinking about things. Does that make sense?
I think you're making absolutely. I think you're making another important point there, which is that evidence-based medicine sounds like a very cold clinical term, that you look at the evidence, you look at the patient, and you put two and two together, and you do what the book tells you to do. But in fact, it's not like that. You treat every patient as an individual, and you look at the age and the background and the medical history and the family history and the diet and the lifestyle, and you treat the patient as an absolute individual. And you, at the same time, you look at the evidence for all of the available treatments, and then you match the treatment to the patient based on the, who the patient is and what the evidence tells you. And as you say, for some children, that may be antibiotics, and for others, it may not be. But that judgment is made on evidence and testing and the experience of how trials have been conducted on hundreds or thousands of children.
Simon, this has been another very, very fast 57 or so minutes for me. We've actually got a couple of minutes left, and I'd always like to kind of end up with what's the overriding message that trick-or-treatment, your book, which is an excellent, excellent overview, I think, of how science works and what we know about alternative treatments in general. What's the overall message? What's the bottom one or two thoughts that you want to leave our listeners with?
One odd one, just something crossed my mind, is in a way there's no such thing as alternative medicine. There are just treatments, and some of them are used very widely, and some of them are fairly well tested, and they generally fall into the branch of what we might call conventional medicine. Others are not so tested and are not so mainstream and maybe more unusual, and they typically fall into the realm of alternative medicine. But whether they're alternative, whether they're conventional, essentially what you need to do is you need to look at the evidence and say, does the evidence for this therapy, is it convincing? Is it value for money? Are the risks low and the benefits high? And apply those tests to all medicines across the board. And if you apply those rules, is it safe? Is it effective? Is there evidence? Is it cost effective? Then you won't go far wrong. And, you know, we've tried to provide the data in the book. We've tried to explain it in a way that we think people will be able to understand and appreciate. And, you know, we've written, if you don't want to get the book, then by all means look it up on the web, borrow it from the library. But get the information, because if you get that information, then you'll be in the right place to make the right decisions about your health and your family's health.
Marcia Angel, who was at the time she made this comment, made a comment similar to what you just tried to say when she was editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. She says there's not really alternative medicines. There's proven and then there's unproven treatments. And that was her way of saying the same thing.
More elegantly than I did.
Well, she probably had a lot more time to think about it.
That's true.
Simon Singh, thanks very much for being our guest today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
All righty. Just a brief mention, next week there is a breast cancer conference called Reducing the Risk, Advancing the Cure, a good conference Friday, October 17th at Providence Cancer Center. You're invited to attend that. And next week, my guest will be Lily Shockney, who will be presenting there. She is a RN at the Breast Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. So as you might expect, we'll be talking about breast cancer and answering your questions about breast cancer with one of our country's moral authorities. So tune into your health and learn more. Next Monday, October 13th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1.
If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.